Then we off we go. At the point of death. See, there's only 5 minutes to go now, and the barrage would lift. And as soon as it lifted, of course, we had to go. Somebody had to go. Now, the barrage lifted, and off we go again. And we get to this point on the other side of the the sunken road. And we kept it. Now, on the top of this road, there was a bank down towards the sunken road, flat road. The ridge went along both sides. The Bourcourt ridge was that side, but there was a ridge this side where we were, see? So we were halfway up the slope that way. Almost near a station. I didn't know it was a station then, but near some buildings of some sort, you know, over there. And we got over there and we had to go down this hill and up the side. Well, when we got on the other side, there's a lot of dugouts there, all the masses there. Well, we got our P-bombs out, you know, for stuck them and chucked them down there. And as you went along, you know, you could smell this bacon. Oh, dear me, a rotten, lousy smell. I think, I don't know, but they said on this particular range there was 28 different entrances to this massive dugouts had been there. In one place had a lift. Some places are 100 feet deep. Now, a medical, you know, sort of hospital in one of them. I didn't see them, but that's what they tell us. There was fire going on all over the place. There was our own sheriffs falling short. There was the jelly short. Fire, there was fire from left and right from this, you know, because our left flank is vacant. Nobody on there at all.
Those haunting words are being spoken by a man called Ordinary Seaman Joseph Murray of the Hood Battalion, the 189th Brigade, the 63rd Royal Naval Division. And he was talking many, many years later, many decades later, about the attack of the Royal Naval Division on the German positions on the Somme around Beaucourt, an area that had been fought over several months before at the beginning of the Battle of the Somme. But it's not the summertime that Joseph's talking about. It's November, the mud of November. And in particular, the 13th of November 1916, when the Hood Battalion, along with several other battalions in the Royal Naval Division, attacks the deep German lines 250 yards in front of them. And it's that particular battle that I want to talk about this week in the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. But we're going to look at the story by talking about one of the officers that was there that day. A man called Frederick Septimus Kelly. In a few days' time, the Olympic Games will begin in France, and in particular around Paris. And the reason why I wanted to talk about Frederick Septimus Kelly was because he was many things. He was a musician and a soldier who lost his life on that day, the 13th of November 1916. But topically for this week, he was a rower, and no ordinary rower, because he won a gold medal in the 1908 Olympic Games. And it was the last time that he rowed a boat. And this is his story. He was the son of an Irish-born war broker. He was born in Sydney, Australia, in May 1881. He was educated at Sydney Grammar School, and then he came to England when he was just a young boy. And he and his five brothers attended Eton School. And it was at Eton that he first learned his rowing skills. In 1899, he stroked the Eton 8 to victory in the Challenge Cup at Henley, the first of many successes. And then he went to college in Oxford. And that's where his skills really developed. On leaving Oxford, he joined the Leander Club in Berkshire, where he was a member of the crew that won the Grand in three successive years, 1903, 4 and 5. He also won the Stewards' Challenge Cup in 1906. His contemporaries held him in high praise. They said his natural sense of poise and rhythm made his boat a live thing under him. And then, as I said just now, his final appearance in a rowing boat came the 1908 London Olympics, where he and his team, the eight men in the boat, took the gold medal for Great Britain. But of those eight men that were in that rowing boat in 1908, six of them served, including Frederick. Three were killed. A seventh remained with a shipbuilding company in Tyneside. And the eighth, a doctor, had died having contracted gangrene while undertaking an operation on a patient. To some, it would seem that that boat that had enjoyed so much success in 1908 was doomed. But outside of rowing, his other passion was music. He'd shown considerable talent for piano as a child. It's said that he could memorise Mozart's Sonatas from a young age, and he began creating his own compositions. He graduated from Oxford with a degree in history, but he decided to pursue music seriously. He even went off to Germany, to Frankfurt, to study music. He made his concert debut back in Australia, in Sydney, in 1911, and performed a number of times in London in the following year. As we're going to look at later, one of his great friends was the famous poet Rupert Brooke, who died in 1915, and the music that you're listening to now is called An Elegy for a String Orchestra in Memoriam to Rupert Brooke. It's said to be his best work. It's certainly the most well known, and as the title would suggest, it's a tribute to his great friend. They served alongside each other before Brooke died of disease on their way to Gallipoli in 1915. Frederick's own service began at the outbreak of the First World War. He was soon commissioned as an officer, and he became part of what was famously called the Latin Club. And this was a group of officers within the Hood Battalion that he joined. As well as Brooke, the Latin Club featured another composer, William Brown, the Prime Minister's, the British Prime Minister's second son, Arthur Asquith, who he called Ock, and a New Zealander who's become famous in the Second World War, Bernard Freyberg, who was to command the Hood Battalion. Frederick served at Gallipoli in 1915. He was twice wounded, only slightly, but he did earn a Distinguished Service Cross for gallantry in action. And when not on patrol or fighting, he spent much of his time in Gallipoli composing. After the Gallipoli evacuation at the end of 1915, beginning of 1916, Frederick spent some time in London, and then his unit was transferred to the Western Front, to France, in May of 1916, and they went into action in the Battle of the Ancre, November 1916, and that's where he met his end. So that's why this week we're going to follow the story of those first few hours of the Battle of the Ancre. But in particular, we're going to follow it through the eyes of the men that were there, as we follow the story of Frederick Septimus Kelly, one of the most talented men that ever walked this earth, and therefore one of the most talented men to lose his life on the Somme in 1916. To do this podcast this week, I'm using mainly a couple of sources to publish books. One's called The Lost Olympian of the Somme. It's his diary that he kept, Frederick Kelly, and it's been edited by the late, great John Cooksey and a good friend of mine, Graham McKechnie, who lives and works here in Northamptonshire for BBC Radio Northampton. And also a book about the history of the Hood Battalion that was written by a man called Leonard Sellers. And in John and Graham's book, in their introduction, they talk about the man himself, who was Frederick Kelly. Having edited his diaries, John and Graham come to the conclusion that he was a very unusual but likeable man. Kelly was the sort of man who would use the songs of Wagner to entice German soldiers to surrender, who could sit in a trench and find the inspiration to compose beautiful melodies and phrases, who could be harsh to the men in those trenches while taking excessive care of stray cats found on the battlefield. And he was the sort of man who inspired the respect of those who served with him and the love and devotion of his many friends. He was eccentric, defiant, rebellious, haughty and brilliant. There are many words which spring to mind when you read the diary of Frederick Kelly, but you cannot help but like him. Now, to all his friends, especially at university and within the rowing world, Frederick was known as Clegg, and that's what we're going to call him. When war broke out in August 1914, Clegg was just like everybody else, all the other menfolk. He was determined to join up and do his bit. But he didn't go down to his local recruitment office and join up. Oh no, he wasn't going to do anything like that. He set out from his house at Bisham on the banks of the River Thames. And where did he go? He went down to Downing Street to get advice from his friend, a man called Maurice Carter. He was the Prime Minister's personal private secretary. And it was from that conversation that he joined up with the prestigious Grenadier Guards. And in early September, he was accepted by the University and Public School Corps. But his time with them was very short-lived. He then heard that there was a new formation called the Naval Brigade, and that was seeking men without experience for commissions. And less than 2 weeks later, he learned that his application to join the Royal Naval Division had been successful. And who was the Royal Naval Division? Well, this was one of the great ideas of Winston Churchill. It was a unit without president in its formation and its makeup. Churchill was then the first Lord of the Admiralty, and he realised that there would be some 20 to 30,000 sailors that wouldn't be needed in the Royal Navy. There were no ships for them. So they decided to turn those men into soldiers, but they would keep their naval ranks, which is why Joe Murray was described as an able seaman. It wasn't just the ranks that were retained within the R&D, Royal Naval Division. They were land-based, but there were other naval traditions. They used naval language and nautical terms. They even allowed their men to have full beards, for of course the British Tommy had to shave every day. Apart from their upper lip, of course, they were allowed to have a moustache. And it was decided that the battalions within the Royal Naval Division would be named after a famous British admiral. So we got Drake, Hawke, Benbow, Collingwood, Nelson, Howe, Anson, and the unit that Clegg was attached to, Hood. And it was during this period that he met Rupert Brooke, who was to become a very close friend. They'd met during basic training in September 1914, and at that stage, Brooke was 27 years old. He was a huge star within the poetry world. He'd been born in Rugby in 1887, where he'd studied at the local school. His father there was a housemaster, then he went up to Cambridge. In 1909, he lived in Cambridgeshire, in the village of Grantchester, and his first volume of poems was published in 1911. And he was to become very famous for the poem that he called The Soldier. The words of that poem sit within a frame at the top of the stairs in my house. He wrote this towards the end of 1914, and it went something like this.
If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven.
It's clear, just listening to those words now, that Rupert and no doubt all of those men that found their way to Gallipoli in 1915 were thinking about what would happen to them beyond death. Would they still be remembered? Would we remember them? But of course we do, and we do so with the help of that very poem and then the words that were written by other poets and authors. As a demonstration of how close Clegg and Brooke had become, he writes in his diary, "In April 1915, I was preparing to go to bed at 8:45 p.m. when Rupert Brooke came into my cabin, and we had a talk about literary matters. I asked him to read me his 5 sonnets, Peace, Safety, the Dead, numbers 1 and 2, and the Soldier. I enjoyed the sound of his voice and the way he read them a good deal, but I don't know if I was conscious of any light being shed upon the lines. I don't understand safety. The others I like very much." And on their way out to Gallipoli, they were on board a ship called the SS Grantley Castle, and it docked in Skyrios on the 20th of April 1915. Once again, Clegg takes up the story of what happened to his great friend. He says, "Rupert Brooke, who was taken ill the night before last, was found to be seriously ill this morning. When several doctors came for a consultation in the afternoon, they held out very small hope of his living. The germ had poisoned his blood through a bad lip, and his face is all swollen up." Apparently what had happened was he'd been bitten by a mosquito. Clegg says, "I looked into his cabin before breakfast, and when I found him very dazed, but I had no idea he was dangerously ill. The doctors made me realise, however, that it was far more likely that he will not live, and I felt very much depressed. I have a foreboding that he's one of those like Keats, Shelley and Schubert who are not suffered to deliver their full message, but there seems to be just the slenderest chance he may live. I saw him carried onto the deck and lowered down into one of the ship's boats to be taken in the steam ship to a French hospital ship, which is in the harbour. Och Asquith went over with him, and by the time I'm writing this, 10:15 p.m, he's not returned. I'm conscious that a really fine talent and rare character hangs in the balance, and it is very galling to hear from the doctors that they can do little but watch the progress of his illness." The following day, the 23rd of April, Clegg says, "The events of today made a deep impression on me. Rupert Brooke died on board a French hospital ship at 4:45, and in view of the ship's orders to sail at 5 a.m. the following morning, arrangements were at once made to bury him on the island he loved so well. I left the ship at 8:15 with a colonel and a second in command, about a dozen officers from this battalion, a few officers of staff, Harold Farrer and Lancelot Cherry. They took us in tow to the French hospital ship. Here we took on the coffin and Oscar Asquith, who, with Dennis Brown, had been tending Rupert, was added to the tow. Charles Lister had gone with Dennis Brown and a working party to dig a grave in the olive grove, which had served as a rendezvous for the 2nd Naval Brigade in the divisional field day last Tuesday, and that's where Rupert began to sicken. It was about a mile from the shore to the grove, over very difficult stony ground, and the petty officers who bore the coffin were obliged to go very slowly. We reached the grove at 10:45 p.m, where in the light of a clouded half-moon, the burial service was read by the chaplain of the 1st Naval Brigade, and a firing party under command of Sub-Lieutenant Patrick Shaw Stewart accorded the body military honours. It was a most moving experience. The small olive grove in the narrow valley and the scent of the wild sage gave a strong classic tone, which so in harmony with the poet we were burying, that to some of us the Christian ceremony seemed out of keeping. When all the others had gone back to the boats, Lieutenant Commander Freyberg, who was Rupert's company commander, Och Asquith, Lister, Brown and I covered the grave with stones and as many pieces of marble as we could find. At the head and feet there were 2 wooden crosses with the name and the date of death, and on them, the larger of them, our Greek interpreter wrote the following inscription." And he wrote it in Greek, but I'll translate it. "Here lies the servant of God, sub-lieutenant in the English Navy, who who died for the deliverance of Constantinople from the Turks. The body lies looking down the valley towards the harbour, and from behind an olive tree bent itself over the grave as though sheltering it from the sun and rain. No more fitting resting place for a poet could be found than this small grove, and it seems as though the gods have jealously snatched him away to enrich this scented island. For the whole day I was oppressed with a sense of loss, but when the officers and men had gone, and when at last the five of us, his friends, had covered his grave with stones and took a last look in silence, then the sense of tragedy gave place to a sense of passionless beauty, engendered both by the poet and the place. On getting back to the ship, I copied out the contents of his notebook before going to bed, as a precaution lest the original should be lost in being sent to England. And then the following morning, they left Skyrios, leaving behind the grave of one of England's greatest ever poets. The following month, on the 21st of May, he's in a headquarters in Gallipoli, and he talks about composing that piece of music that we listened to earlier in the podcast about Rupert Brooke. He says, ever since the day of Brooke's death, I've been composing an elegy for string orchestra, the ideas of which are coloured by the surrounding of his grave and the circumstances of his death. Today I felt my way right through to the end of it, though of course much of it is still to take on a definite shape. The model character of his music seems to be suggested by the Greek surroundings, as well as Rupert's character, some passage work by the rustling of the olive tree which bends over his grave. It should work out to be some 9 minutes in performance. It was during the Gallipoli campaign on the 4th of June 1915 that Clegg was wounded. He says, we were under a heavy fire, and on turning to get back to my trench, I was hit on the inside of the right heel by a grazing bullet, which made a wound about 2 inches long and about half an inch deep in the centre. It cut the side of my boot open. It was a dreadful day for the Royal Naval Division, the 4th of June, 1915. The division went into action that day with 70 officers and 1,900 men from the three assaulting battalions. By the end of the day, 61 of those 70 officers had become casualties, and over 1,300 of the 1,900 of the ranks were also casualties. And it was established at that time that 167 of them had been killed. The ridge in front of them stood defiant, still barring the way to Constantinople. And as we now know, the British were never to get to Constantinople, or Istanbul as we now call it. And eventually, the Allied forces, including the Anzacs, had to evacuate the Gallipoli Peninsula. Now, going back to Joseph Murray, who we started the podcast with, he had quite a sense of humour. And in his interview with the Imperial War Museum, he was asked whether they came up with any songs about Gallipoli. And yes, they did. And not only did he describe the song, he sang it for us. And I want to play it for you here.
How about the old Gallipoli? I said, righto, off we go. And there was about four or five of us Gallipoli men. And we all joined in. Do you want me to sing it for you? Yes, I'm not a Caruso.
Don't worry about it.
Or a Count McCormick, but anyway, here we go. It's a parody on the Irish song, Tom Moore's Irish song, about the Muttons of Mourn, where the Muttons of Mourn roll down to the sea. It goes on, the old Gallipoli is a terrible place where the talks in the trenches the lads had to face. But they never murmured, but smiled through it all. Very soon they expected that he was about to fall. At least when I asked them, that's what they told me. And in Constantinople, we'd have a fine spree. But if the war lasted to doomsday, it's there we would be, where the old Gallipoli sweeps down to the sea. The morning we landed, I'll never forget, as we stood on the beach with our clothes wringing wet. Although we were soaking right through to the skin, we had no time to dig ourselves in. We went over the brow into that withering fire, and some of our pals got caught on the wire. But we that were free went on doggedly where the mountains of Mourne roll down to the sea. We don't grow, no, we took several trenches before we could stop, for we fully had Johnny Turk right on the hop. When he saw the caps and the tallies we wore, he just turned round and fled without asking for more. He cried, Allah, Allah, but that was no use, for we were determined to take no excuse. We showed him the bayonet which meant R.I.P., where the old Gallipoli sweeps down to the sea. We don't grow potatoes or barley or wheat, but we're eye on the lookout for something to eat. We are fed up with bully dry biscuits and burnt ham, and we are sick of the sight of that apricot jam. We like steak and onions, fried ham and eggs, or a nice big fat chicken with five or six legs, and a drop of the stuff that begins with a B, where the old Gallipoli sweeps down to the sea. While in the trenches, wild rumours you hear, it's enough to make any man go on the beam. They say that we're all going home very soon, but I'd sooner believe there's a man on the moon. They say that in England they're waiting for us, and when we arrive there will be a great fuss. But we didn't believe them. It's here we would be, where the old Gallipoli sweeps down to the sea. All right?
That's good.
Made me smile there, listening to him, hearing him chuckle at the end of the song there. Despite the horror of Gallipoli and the Western Front, obviously brought back happy memories for Joe. He's going to reappear a bit later on in the podcast. Everyone that's done a documentary or a podcast or book or anything about the Royal Naval Division talks about their new commanding officer that took over in October of 1916, Major General Cameron, nicknamed Tiger Shoot. Now, he was an old soldier that had seen action in the Sudan many, many years earlier during the 1880s, and he didn't have much time for the RND, the Royal Naval Division, when he took over on the 17th of October. And he was particularly critical of what he saw about the trench management of the RND. He said he saw kit strewn about willy-nilly and rifles plastered with mud. It is said that Shute was forever carrying out inspections and inspecting the trenches and finding lots of fault. He was critical of the layout and construction of the latrines. He said that poor field hygiene in these atrocious, muddy conditions will lead to outbreaks of dysentery. And I suppose he had got a point, but it's the same as anything, isn't it? It's how you communicate that, which did get under people's skins. There was a man, a poet called A.P. Herbert. He was serving in the Hawk Battalion, and he wrote a poem, which, as I said, must have been repeated in so many documentaries, radio programmes, and podcasts that I just can't resist doing it. So I'm going to have a go at reading it in the spirit that it was written by that man, A.P. Herbert. He says, the general inspecting the trenches exclaims with a horrified shout, I refuse to command a division which leaves his excreta about. But nobody took any notice, no one was prepared to refute, that the presence of shit was congenial compared to the presence of shoot. And certain responsible critics made haste to reply to his words, observing that his staff advisers consisted entirely of turds. For shit may be shot at odd corners, and paper supplied there to suit, but a shit would be shot without mourners if someone shot that shit shoot. I just about got there, but you get the gist of it, don't you? The black humour of the soldiers in the trenches reminds me of the Wipers Times, which every time I go to Ypres, I walk past the ramparts where that was produced, and it reminds me that one day I must produce a podcast about that satirical publication. by the Sherwood Foresters, but that is very much for another day. There's another diary entry that caught my attention as I went through the book, and it's Monday the 29th of May 1916, and he says, "It's my birthday, and I reflected that another 35 years will probably see me out. Life seems suddenly to have ceased to be an eternity, and I must disillusion myself of the fiction that I'm a young man with a whole career in front of me." At the same time, Beethoven was writing his Fifth Symphony, a depressing comparison. Of course, what he didn't know at this stage was that his 35th birthday, May 1916, was to be his last birthday, and he literally only had a few months to live. It must have occurred to him, that thought, when he wrote those notes. He'd seen enough death and destruction and horror during the months he spent at Gallipoli to know that his war wasn't over and that worse was to come. So he then spent some time at home in London, but it was at the beginning of October 1916 that the Hood Battalion arrived with Clegg on the Somme battlefield. By this time, of course, the battle had been raging since the 1st of July. So for 3 months, the battlefield in the northern part of the Somme, where the Hood Battalion was to advance against the Germans, dug in. And his diary entry, the 2nd of October 1916, sums up the situation quite well. He said it was a wet, depressing day, but the rain was not too heavy to interfere with the company doing bayonet fighting for the greater part of the morning. I had the NCOs in at 2:30 and read them out some notes about the recent Somme fighting. We'd heard definitely that we were to go to the Somme in the afternoon and quite shortly. There was a company commander's meeting at 6 p.m, at which Freyberg passed on the information he'd got at a previous battalion commander's meeting. According to this, the authorities are confident the next push would be decisive, an absolute ascendancy having been established over the Germans, who are said to be demoralised. I think there is more in this than the customary assurances given before one goes in to have one's head broken. But my memory goes back to the 4th of June 1915 and Dennis Brown's charming optimism. So there we go. On the one hand, he's saying that he's optimistic about the future, that maybe the Germans are broken, are demoralised, are about to capitulate. But he then reminds himself that just 4 months earlier, at Gallipoli, they said the same about the Turks, and one of his best mates was killed along with so many others that day. They couldn't possibly know what was ahead of them on those Somme battlefields. There was no way they could have known that. Not at this stage, anyway. So we now turn our attention to a little discussed battle by so many people. The extension, really, of the main Battle of the Somme, the northern part of the Somme battlefield, known forever as the Battle of the Onc being the river that runs off the Somme. And the Germans were still very much in place here, as they had been 4 months before at the beginning of the Somme on the 1st of July. The 63rd Royal Naval Division was to fight in the area north of the Onc River, but the weather was going to be the big problem. Haig and Gough, the commander of the 5th Army, would need the weather to improve sufficiently for the attack to take place before winter set in. The new offensive was planned to start on the 13th of November, and there was to be 12 divisions involved, including the Royal Naval Division and also the Canadians. The Royal Naval Division had no previous experience of a large offensive operation in France. This was the first time that they were to undergo such a campaign. So our friend Shute held two conferences for brigadiers, brigade staffs and all the commanding officer. He explained the plan, the outline plan. He covered all the points he wished to be explained to the troops. And he said that he wanted the attack to be practiced if time permitted. The New Zealander that we talked about earlier, Bernard Freyberg, was the commanding officer of the Hood Battalion. And he wrote in his memoirs that Shute had decided that new assembly trenches would be dug across the brigade front in one night, the night before the battle. And Freyberg said that the most difficult part was getting the men out quickly, quietly and with no confusion. As they arrived in a constant stream, only 100 yards from the enemy machinery, a system of guides had to be pre-arranged to prevent any congestion from occurring. So what he's saying here is one of the biggest challenges in the weather and the darkness is getting so many men in the right place at the right time to jump out of their assembly positions. He said the bulk of the men came from reserve battalions and had to march from their rest billets that were 4 miles away along a road and then face a long, slow, tedious tramp in the dark, 2,000 or 3,000 yards up muddy and narrow communication trenches, where every forward step had to be felt for, while a hand shielded the face and neck from being caught on the telephone wires which crossed and recrossed the trenches everywhere. The Hood officers were chosen for the attack, and Clegg was in B Company. They were to take up the position on the extreme right. In addition to the officers that were to go into attack, other ranks would amount to 535. So the battalion was nowhere near at full strength. Freyberg was well aware of the task that awaited them. He said, "We had, when we marched up to the Somme battle, some 52 officers of unequal quality, and we knew that when we marched out in a few weeks' time, only a third would remain. It was important that battalions should be officered by good men both after as well as during the battle, and the complement of officers we were allowed to take into each assault was 20. So we decided to take our 12 best and our 8 worst. The worst were all told why they were picked and that they would have good men in front and behind to keep an eye on them. Often these officers, spurred on by the thought that they were undergoing a careful examination, excelled. They were given unstinted praise and recognition, and having once done well, they seldom looked back." Now, the attack was due to go in at 5:45 a.m. on the 13th of November, and Freyberg recounted in his memoirs once again what happened in those hours before. He says, "At midnight I went round our battalion and had to step over men as I walked. It was unnaturally quiet. The men all seemed asleep, but closer inspection showed them awake, lying there with their heads on their arms, peering out into the night. One or two spoke, but the bulk seemed to be in another world. I asked some of them next night as we lay out in the shell holes in front of Beaucourt what they were thinking about. They all said their thoughts were of the future. None thought of the past." The tension must have been terrible from those men of all qualities, from different ranks, from the private to lieutenant colonel, as they waited for 0 hour. So many men throughout history must have gone through the same thoughts, the same worries, the same tensions. We can hear again from our friend Joe Murray as he explains what it was like.
"You see, now, we've been walking about all night, and we got to our assembly point at 7 o'clock. Official record says 9, but that was when it was complete. We were the first ones. We had everybody's way, so we were at 7 o'clock. At 7 p.m., the attack was due to 5:45 the next morning. We got 14 hours to wait. In the mist it was, and the rain, you know, because people will swear, you know, 400 of water, bloody, you know, there was an awful lot of noise. Although we were trying to keep quiet, knowing the position, we didn't know where the Germans were. But we knew there was somebody in front. But we had a patrol in front of us, which would give us a bit of warning. They couldn't help us, but it was just warning. And we knew what we had to attack. We knew that they'd been there months and months, and you know, so and we were getting a bit shaky. No doubt about it. We were getting a bit shaky because we seemed to be, you know, dog's bodies. We dug in at October the 4th, we dug in October the 15th, we dug in again and so on, and now the attack has gone. And we've done all the donkey work, and now we're going to do all the fighting. That was, you know, well, why doesn't somebody else have to go with it? Honestly, we were getting a bit shaky because we ceased well in the conversation. You know, we weren't quite sure what each man was thinking. But I suppose they were all thinking that, well, look, this is, you know, a bit too much. We've got 300 yards, the trench. And we've got 100 yards deep, and we've got 4 lines of men. So then we've got 1,000. And, you see, all the way along the front was like that. Next to us was the Hawke and the Nelson. Beyond them was the Howe and the Anson. And beyond them was the Marines and so on. Wow.
Now, in this passage, Joseph talks about a visit from their commanding officer, the aforementioned Bernard Freyberg. and the surprise when he sees his commanding officer in the trenches with him. And our man Clegg also gets a mention.
Now, we in the Hood, under Colonel Freiburg, was right on the right flank, almost on the river. In fact, the river was our boundary. As I say, during the night, it was dark, it was misty, and there was a slight drizzle, I think, you know. It may have been the mist. But I remember lying in the front there, and it must have been about midnight. I'm not sure. But I saw someone coming along, and I thought to myself, well, who's that walking about in front here, you know? And I heard him talking, so. So lying in this hole, and I remember lying there, and I've got a sack of blinking bombs on my head, you know. Oh, dear me, they're lousy things. You know, coming up the communication trench, you got tied up with this telephone wire everywhere you go, and you've got your rifle over here, and you go around here and on the net, and you pull like hell, and then you trip over, and the sack would fall on the mud in below. Well, a wet sack is an uncomfortable thing at any time, but get a wet and muddy sack around the back of your neck is not very comfortable, but you have to have them. You say, oh, yes, I have them. And I heard this fella talking, see, and I suddenly find out that, oh, it's Colonel Freiburg. Freiburg, he'd come along to inspect his troops, you know, before the attack. The generals do 10 miles away, you know, quite safely. But Freiburg, he was coming along, apparently, because he went past me eventually and went on to see his old pal, Kelly, B Company. B Company was on the right of us. Now, there was Asquith, Freiburg, and Kelly, with the only three men, officers, left out of the whole crowd, you know, nearly 100, that left Grand Tully Castle, left Aymouth on the Grand Tully Castle in February. It was Freiburg, F.S. Kelly, he was a classical scholar, a diamond scholar winner too, and Asquith. They were the only three left. And he said to me, he says, oh, well, nice to see you again. You know, he was quite cheerful, wondering how we're getting on, and do try and get some sleep, you know, so. On out.
But then eventually, after a long, hard night waiting in the cold, it's 0 hour, 5:45 a.m, and there was a sub-lieutenant, John Bentham, in the first wave of the Hoods. And he said this: directly the barrage lifted, we in the first wave got up and walked slowly forward, as one had to be careful not to walk into our barrage. In spite of the intensity of the barrage, machine guns began taking a toll of those of us advancing. Where there had been hundreds on either side of me, I seemed to be alone with my runners and bodyguard. Everything was smoke and hell let loose. The first group of Germans we came to had their hands up, except one who I shot through the stomach. We threw phosphorus bombs down the dugouts, which forced the inmates to come up, and some of my men bayoneted them as they did so. Prisoners were sent to the rear after being disarmed, and not being able to spare any men to go with them, a lot were shot on sight by the waves coming behind. Suddenly a shell burst among us, and when the smoke had cleared, I found my two runners killed. I was wounded myself through the thigh, and nearly all of the remainder were maimed. I gave my map and instructions to an NCO and told him to carry on, but he was killed just as he left me. This was exactly 6:15 a.m. We'd certainly had a hectic half an hour, and now it was all over. One of my lads was wounded in the lung and was coughing up bright red blood, and it wasn't long before he died. The remainder took what shelter we could in the crater, as the enemy were plastering us with shells. Wave after wave of reinforcements passed us shouting, "Got a blighty, lucky devil!" And then we got our first aid packages and bandaged our wounds as best we could. My leg was pumping with blood. And now we can turn back again to Joe Murray, who tells us what he saw and what he experienced.
5:45, all the watches were synchronised. Bang, 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 bang. All of a sudden, behind us, the whole sky was red. Immediately afterwards, you could hear the shells going over your head, and really and truly, you can almost feel them. Almost feel the shell. And then you heard the sound. You see, but, you know, the shell was quicker than the light was first. The shell was next, and then the sound. Like the Dardanelles, but the Dardanelles was over the water. And it would take 28 seconds. But here, it was a matter of 5 or 6 seconds. 5:45 ago, we know that at 6:05, 20 minutes, we'd be on our objective. That's the line. The first line, we used to call it the dotted green line. The second line was the green line. Now, the Green Line was just over the Silken Road, beside Beaucourt Station. The Reach came right along both sides, you see. You couldn't see who the first one, you just guess on them, you know. You couldn't see. And of course, it was misty and dark, and 6:05. The Drake was to go through us and capture the Green Line. Not the Drake. We knew Dollard Line, so we were going to capture the Green Line. Now, they were going to capture the next one. They were going to capture the Yellow Line, you see. Away on our left, for some reason or other, there was a big redoubt in between Jerry's first and second, you know, in the front line. There was a big redoubt there called the Whaleback Redoubt. On the other side of the river, there was a Leipzig Redoubt and a Schwaben Redoubt and so on. It was massive, you know, concentrations of guns. And somehow or another, it wasn't touched by all this fire, weak fire. It was left untouched, never touched. There was some mistake somewhere. Well, the Hawk was immediately in front of that. So when the Hawk moved up and the Howe on their left moved up against this blinking Whaleback Redoubt, and they got sorted. Now, the Nelson, of course, when it starts, nobody can stop it. The Nelson, now, the Drake, for some reason, you've seen the fighting going over here, got attracted to one another, and most of the Drakes got mixed up with it. So instead of a battalion of Drakes, say, of 500 men, maybe, there was only three officers in what? I suppose about 60 or 70 men. Well, five hogs, you know, we paused there. I forget how long we had to wait sometime, but the time was getting on. Almost near the station. I didn't know it was a station then, but near some buildings of some sort, you know, over there. And we got over there and we had to go down this hill and up this side. Well, when we got on the other side, there's a lot of dugouts there, all the masses there. Well, we got our P-bombs out, you know, for stuck them and chucked them down there. And as you went along, you know, you could smell this blinking. Oh, dear me, a rotten, lousy smell, but it was the best of all. And I saw some crowd over here, and, you know, really and truly, I thought they were all men, but they were really prisoners. I think, I don't know, but they said on this particular range there was 28 different entrances to this massive dugouts had been there. In one place had a lift. Some places are 100 feet deep. Now, a medical, you know, full hospital in one of them. I didn't see them, but that's what they tell us. You see? And they came out these P-bombs, you know, and phosphorus, and all come. And look, we start talking about these fellas, you know, when they couldn't understand what we... Well, we couldn't hear. There was no bloody noise. But, you know, soldier knows what the point of a bender means. Quick. No, get back. And we've got to still go further, you see. You know, we go onto this Green Line on the other side, and really, too, there seemed to be more prisoners giving themselves up than what there was fighting men. There was fighting going on all over the place. There was our own sheriffs falling short, there was the jelly short, firing, and we were firing from left and right from this, you know, because our left flank is vacant. Nobody on there at all. You see, the Howe had got through and the remains got through a far side, but there was that gap, you know, of what, 300-600 yards.
Now, during this podcast, we've read quite a lot of the diary that was written by Clegg. And his final entry was on Saturday, the 11th of November, 1916. He says it was a dull, misty, still day and the sun did not appear. I walked to Martinsart for a good hot bath at 10:30 a.m. Martinsart. Just remember that name of that village for a few minutes. We had a parade at midday and 3 o'clock. Early in the afternoon, I tested some fuses of P-bombs and we set alight to two P-bombs in a trench at the back of our billets on the other side of the road. They emitted a great deal of smoke. There was an officers' meeting at 6 p.m. It appears to be X Day. Sunday the 12th of November 1916, Hood Battalion. And then the page is blank. There were no further entries. Because as we were listening to the words of Bentham and Joe Murray, our man Clegg was to meet his end. What happened to him? Well, his good friend, Lieutenant Colonel Bernard Freyberg, commanding officer of Hood Battalion, he can tell us because he wrote down what happened. And this is what he said. He said Kelly's last day was spent inspecting his company battle arrangements, the rifles, gas mask, iron rations, water bottles and ammunition of all ranks had to be carefully examined, Lewis guns to be checked and the necessary drums of ammunition filled, while the special battle stores such as mills and smoke bombs, wire cutters, aeroplane flares, very lights, SOS signals and carrier pigeons had to be issued to the correct people. Company commanders like Kelly lectured to all ranks who were taking part in the attack and then examined the non-commissioned officers to make certain they understood the main features of the scheme. He then talks about going up to the trenches and talking to the men, just as Joe Murray had described, and he says that Kelly was in very high spirits, certain as he always was that the war would be over in the spring, and he came back to my headquarters in a shell hole for brigade time, which was to come to us at midnight. What he means there is synchronised watches. On the extreme right, overlooking the River Onk, with only a minute or two before the attack was launched, I had my last talk with Kelly. We'd been daily companions for the last 2 years, and he, Asquith, and I were the sole survivors of the battalion that left Avonmouth for Gallipoli at the commencement of 1915. I wanted to wish him Godspeed, but somehow it seemed too theatrical. Instead, we talked rather awkwardly and synchronised our watches. Our task in the battle was to capture the frontline system, and as we advanced northeast by compass, we passed the burning entrances of dugouts, which showed that phosphorus bombs were taking effect. These dugouts were elaborate two-storied affairs, with electric light in one case a lift. It was in rushing a strong point at the entrance to one of these that Kelly was killed. Owing to our heavy casualties, it was never really known how it happened, but it appears that someone on Kelly's left had missed a dugout entrance from which the enemy was starting to shoot. Unless the strong point was captured at once, enemy machine guns would pop up everywhere. Hesitation would have endangered the success of the whole attack on our front. Kelly, being an experienced soldier, knew this quite as well as he must have known the risk he was taking, when with the few men he had hastily gathered, he rushed the machine gun. A few of the men reached the position, but Kelly, with most of them, was killed at the moment of victory. It was but one of several similar incidents which made our success possible that day. At 6:05 a.m. we'd completed the capture of our objective. The losses in the attack were enormous. Of the 25 officers and 535 other ranks who'd crossed No Man's Land 20 minutes earlier, but four officers and 250 men answered the roll call on the captured objective. Kelly and others of our best men did not give their lives in vain, for that night those few square yards of ours were the most precious on the Western Front. They enabled the 5th Army to exploit northward, and they were the sole avenue of approach by which reinforcements could be hurried during darkness to our weak line in front of Beaucourt. Had the enemy been able to close this hole between ourselves and the river, the history of the Battle of the Onk, and perhaps the Somme itself, would have to be rewritten. Now, the Hood Battalion's medical officer was a man called William McCracken, and he found Kelly's body, and he said he was shot through the back of the head just opposite a dugout in the German third line. He wrote to Clegg's mate, Arthur Asquith, saying he felt like crying at the sight of the dead and the plight of the seriously wounded. His comrades then buried him in the village of Hamel, which was just behind the British lines. But when the process of concentration was introduced by the Imperial War Graves Commission later on, his body was exhumed and moved to Martinsar Military Cemetery, more than a mile away. A beautiful spot today, Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery, of course. And that's where, in his final diary entry, Clegg had told us that he was having a bath in the same village where he now lies forever. As I always do, I try and find a German perspective of what happened that day. And I found a report from the Germans, and it simply read, "Not a great deal can be found out concerning the events in the first position, because very few men of the two battalions there ever came back." What happened to Joe Murray? Well, during the attack he was hit by a shell, wounded, and that was the end of his war. So the next thing I did was have a look and see how many men from the Hood Battalion died on the 13th of November, and the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website tells me that there were 60 men that fell that day, including Kelly. Of those 60, 17 of them are still missing, and 39 of them are buried in the Ulk British Cemetery, which is virtually where the front line trenches, the British front line trenches, were located on that day, on the 13th of November 1916. Their bodies were found after the war and buried in the Ulk British Cemetery. It would seem logical that when the concentration process was carried out in the early 1920s, that Clegg was buried with those men in the Ulk Cemetery. But for some reason, he was taken, as we said, back to Martinsar, where he lies today. And where, when I visit the battlefield, the Somme, in a few weeks' time, I'm going to walk that battlefield and I'm going to end up paying my respects to him at his grave. It's a very quiet corner of the battlefield now. Not many people tend to go there. I've visited Beaucourt a number of times. I've visited the Ulk Cemetery a number of times, and I don't recall seeing people there. It's not on the tourist trail, but it's not far from the Tietvaal Memorial. It's not far from the Ulster Cafe, where you can have a sandwich lunch before heading downhill. And in fact, when you stand outside the Ulster Cafe, looking towards Tietvaal Wood with your backs to the cafe, look to the right, look down the hill and then up the other side, and you can see the Ulk Cemetery, which I said is the starting point, jumping off positions for the Royal Naval Division that day. And then if you look across to the right, you can see the entire battlefield. And at certain times of the year when the fields have been ploughed, you can see the chalky lines of what was the trenches of those opposing sides. They're still there. And of course, as we know, some of those men are still there. And if you then walk the battlefield, across the fields, across the paths, the lanes, the road that goes between Hamel and Beaucourt takes you uphill just as they try to. You've got the river on your right-hand side, the modern railway line on your right-hand side, and then you come to the old Beaucourt station that Joe Murray mentioned a number of times. It's derelict now. It's where a lot of those German prisoners were taken to. But you can just get a feel for what happened there all those years ago. And then continue walking up into the village of Beaucourt. And on the left-hand side, as you come into the village, there's an obelisk, the memorial to the Royal Naval Division. And on the front of that obelisk is a large bronze plaque. The memorial was unveiled on the 12th of November 1922. It was performed by General Sir Hubert Gough. And there was approximately 200 officers and men from the Royal Naval Division that fought that day that were there. And the words on the memorial simply say, "In memory of the officers and men of the Royal Naval Division who fell at the Battle of the Ulk, November the 13th and 14th, 1916. And there was a man called Lord Rothermere. He offered to provide the funding for the memorial. And that's because his son, the Honourable Vere Harmsworth, had been killed in battle on that day, and he was serving with the Hawk Battalion. And he's buried in the Ankara British Cemetery that I mentioned just now. And while I was carrying out the research for this podcast, I came across another poem that was written by the same man that wrote the poem, the unfavourable poem about General Shute. But this one was a little different, and he simply called the poem Beaucourt Revisited.
I wandered up to Beaucourt, I took the river track, and saw the lines we lived in before the Boche went back. The peace was now in pottage, and the front was far ahead. The front had journeyed eastward, and only left the dead. And I thought how long we lay there, and watched across the wire, while guns roared round the valley and set the skies afire. But now there are homes in Hamel, and tents in the Vale of Hell, and a camp at Suicide Corner, where half a regiment fell. The new troops follow after, and tread the land we won. To them 'tis so much hillside, we rested from the Hun. We only walk with reverence this sullen mile of mud. The shell holes hold our history, and half of them our blood. Here, at the head of Pesh Street, 'twas death to show your face. To me, it seemed like magic to linger in the place. For me, how many spirits hung around the Kentish caves. But the new men see no spirits. They only see the graves. I found the half-dug ditches we fashioned for the fight. We lost a score of men there. Young James was killed that night. I saw the star shells staring. I heard the bullets hail. But the new troops passed unheeding. They never heard the tale. I crossed the blood-red ribbon. It once was no man's land. I saw a misty daybreak and a creeping minute hand. And here the lads went over, and there was Harmworth shot. And here was William lying. But the new men knew them not. And I said, there is still the river, and still the stiff, stark trees, to treasure here our story. But there are only these. But under the whitewood crosses, the dead men answered low. The new men know not Beaucourt, but we are here. We know.
Like so many men that fell during the Great War from all nations, Clegg was a very talented man. Talented with his music, talented with his sport, rowing in particular, and talented as a leader of men. During the 20th century, he was really forgotten about. But during the centenary of the Great War, he once more came back into the notice of people, not just from Britain, but from Australia, where he was born. On the 17th of August 2014, as part of a special concert commemorating the centenary outbreak of the Great War, the BBC Proms played Kelly's Elegy. And 2 years before that, it was played by the National Symphony Orchestra during the 2012 Henley Festival. Now, that was just a few feet away from Kelly's greatest sporting triumph as an oarsman in 1908, because that's where he won his gold medal during those Olympic Games. Kelly had a friend, a man he shared a flat with, a man called Leonard Borwick, and he spoke of Kelly's writing of that elegy. He said it was no mere expression of personal grief or loss, but a symbol rather of the continuity of life, giving thoughts of eternity. And as such, for all who knew or loved Clegg Kelly, his own most fitting and perfect memorial. The Olympic Games, as I said at the start of the podcast, is due to start in a few days. And when I sit down to watch it, I'll be watching the rowing in particular, and as I do so, I'll be thinking of Clegg Kelly. I'll be wondering what he could have achieved had he not died in that field in November 1916, bravely attacking that pillbox, leading from the front. But it wasn't to be. We'll never know what he would have achieved. But we do know by listening to this podcast, reading the books that I've mentioned, that we keep his memory alive. And as usual, at the end of the podcast, we'll play the last post in memory of Clegg and Rupert Brooke, who died of disease before the Battle of the Somme, and all those others that perished in the battle around Beaucourt, November 1916. And we'll do that by playing the last post.